with me. There is nothing like a good story. And when you dive into the treasure trove of stories from our state, the folk tales, the legends, the lore, you find a really rich collection from many traditions: Native American, French, English, Finnish, and African American. Writer Cheryl James has done the diving into that treasure trove of stories, and the result is her very entertaining book, Michigan Legends, Folk Tales and Lore from the Great Lakes State. It's published by the University of Michigan Press. Cheryl joins us in the studio. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what drew you to decide to assemble this rich collection of stories and legends?
Well, it actually came about as the result of an invitation. U of M Press was launching some Michigan regional, a line of Michigan regional books. And I and others who have been journalists for long periods of time and are practiced writers, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. I was invited to do this particular book. And it was a real adventure for me. I've been writing features for 30-some years of all kinds, but this material really, you know, expanded my horizons, and it was a great adventure.
And it really, you had to go back way, way back, all the way up to fairly recently. So you really covered Michigan's history with all of this.
You know, that was one of the parameters or the goals of the book, was to have readers learn something about Michigan geography, Michigan history, as well as, of course, the Michigan legends and the people who have forged this state. And we wanted to keep with pretty original Michigan kinds mm-hmm. of tales. And for that reason, some more recent ethnic folk tales are not in this book.
Okay.
That would make a whole nother book. So,
well, when we talk about myths and legends and folklore and folk tales, and as you dug into this, how much do you think is fact and how much is fiction that just gets better and better and more fanciful with each retelling?
Well, that's a great question. And it depends on the chapter we're talking about, because they, as you know, there's a huge range of total fantasy here, as well as pretty historical kinds of things.
But when we have things like, oh, the talking horse from back in the French settling days, perhaps that was just fun to tell.
Yeah, I couldn't resist putting a little humor in the book, the talking mare.
I love the talking mare. Well, let's give folks a sampling of some of the stories in your book. I really enjoyed Start in Detroit, and really take us back to those very, very early days of the French settlers in Michigan. Here in Michigan, we talk about the Nain Rouge. I know anybody who took French is probably cringing right now, but that's how it's said today. Who's the Nain Rouge?
It's the red dwarf demon of Detroit. It goes way back. In fact, in the chapter, they talk about it coming actually from France. Mm-hmm. And it's the particular haunt of Detroit. And it's this little red impish creature that has been known to appear right before Detroit's greatest tragedies. And so if you appease the Nain Rouge, the tragedy may not befall you. But if you do not pay him due respect, watch out.
And I recall news coverage just this past March. Folks got together for the march and the ceremony to banish the Nain Rouge. So
yeah,
this little devil's still on people's minds in 2013 in Detroit.
Absolutely. And his image is on all kinds of T-shirts and hats and that sort of thing. So he's somewhat likable in that respect.
Now, let's go over to everybody knows, if you're in Southeast Michigan, about Fort Wayne, historic Fort Wayne, sadly still closed to the public. But I remember going there as a kid. It had been open to the public. But I wasn't aware it's haunted or it's supposedly haunted.
You know, I didn't know that either. There's a lot of this I never knew. This is why this was such a fun book to explore. And I had never been to Fort Wayne either. Always had wanted to get there, never had. And I was surprised to hear this. So when I met with these gentlemen who do these paranormal investigations, they were pretty serious about what they're doing, and we wanted to avoid the ghost, the commercial ghost aspect, and really try to get a little more serious about what they're trying to do. But apparently these sounds and voices that come from an empty room and an empty building have been recorded, and these strange photographs of ghostly figures have been taken. There's three or four of them, a couple of them, the most notable, we were not able to publish. Just because the family that owns it wants to keep it private.
So how recently have the reports come? I mean, understanding that 20th century, it's been since the 20th century. So we aren't just going back to the 1800s.
No, we're not. They've recorded these voices recently, in the past few years. And then, of course, there are other stories that go very far back. And the interesting thing about Fort Wayne that I found is how far back it does go. You know, it was, they first built it in 1849, and it really has been a great presence in Michigan history, Detroit history, and not just from the fort standpoint, but the Indian mounds that were there.
Yes.
That was very fascinating to me. Just the constant intermingling of white Europeans mm-hmm. and Native Americans was fascinating to me. There was far more interaction throughout all of this time than I ever realized.
Which we really see in your book. I'm speaking with Cheryl James, her book, Michigan Legends, Folk Tales and Lore from the Great Lakes State, published by the University of Michigan Press. Let's go to the thumb. And Paul Bunyan is talked about as a Michigan man. Now, somehow, I always thought Paul Bunyan was from Minnesota, and I have no idea why I always thought that. But Michigan's claiming Paul Bunyan?
Yes, we are. We can tell Minnesota to back off.
He's ours.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was one of the longer chapters. A great deal of research went into that to make it a Paul Bunyan chapter that offers new material, mm-hmm. a new twist, that sort of thing. But it really does is pegged on that 1906 article in the Oscoda Press. It is the first time that the name is ever actually in print. And though stories of Paul Bunyan date back to French Canada, since Michigan and Canada, all of that was the same area,
sure.
you know, it kind of relates. But a lot of people don't realize that it was only after 1906 and a little bit later, a couple decades later, I think, that Paul Bunyan was kind of used as a marketing figure. And it was after that he just exploded.
And then everybody claimed him.
Exactly. But prior to that, you know, it was in that 1906 article. Huh. And the book republishes that article. We shade it
yeah.
because it's hard to read a little bit. It's told in the lingo of 1906. But you'll see when you read it that his name is, he's just kind of an ordinary guy. He's not the big hero and gigantic figure that he later becomes.
With the big babe, the yeah. blue ox. So,
exactly.
So that looks like taking that process of taking something that happened and embellishing.
Greatly yes, embellishing.
Greatly embellishing. Let's head to the Upper Peninsula and we get the Finnish contribution here. Talk to us about the Bloodstoppers. That's something I never had heard of.
Well, I hadn't either, and it was one of the few things from the Upper Peninsula we were able to include. And it was Richard Dorson's incredible research in the Upper Peninsula with these various groups of people. There are so many ethnic groups up there, mm-hmm. the Finnish, the Welsh, Swedes. And he did just an enormous amount of research, and it was a lot of fun to read his book. It was very thorough. And it was just one of those tales that we thought fit into, you know, the parameters of this book. But I certainly had never heard that someone could just speak, you know, has this special power and
so how does
speak
it work?
The
what
word.
Is, what does a Bloodstopper do?
Well, a Bloodstopper, it has to be born that way. And they're supposed to be the seventh daughter or son.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just born with this ability to simply either, if they know someone is bleeding, they can either say a certain number of words, either on site or off site, and the blood stops, the bleeding stops. And the chapter does go into a little bit of a Finnish prayer. They think it might be from the Bible, but they're not sure. Mm-hmm. But the person who says it just simply has this mystical power to stop bleeding.
Are these mystical blood stoppers around in 2013 that we're aware of?
It would be very nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
we'd put them in the military or something. That could help
yeah.
us a lot.
Yeah, but as far as, so that it dates back 1800s, we're talking about that?
Yeah, that's a little yeah. more recent than some of the French. You know, the Detroit tales obviously are much older because mm-hmm. Detroit is so old. And I think there's a lot of people who kind of forget that, mm-hmm. that just how old Detroit goes back, you know, is.
Very much
how far
so.
It goes back.
And I have to say that with the spring that we have had with playing hide and go seek, I had to ask you to talk about the Western Michigan legend about why Michigan's weather is so changeable. And that comes from our Native American sources, doesn't it?
Yes, a great deal of material. It's overwhelming, all the wonderful legends and folktales from the from Indians and Native Americans. But yeah, I couldn't pass that one up.
Yeah. So why is our weather so changeable?
It's the only explanation. Well, there's these two Indians who were having a race. And the one Indian was always faster than the other. And I would try to say their names, but frankly, I cannot pronounce them. They're long, wonderful Indian names. And so they have this great race, and as the one who always loses, he works harder and harder to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he reaches a place, it's nice and sunny. And then when the other reaches, he catches up, and then it cools down. So depending on who's winning the race, the weather changes. So I thought after this spring, completely on point.
They're busy out there racing. And then finally, in our last minute or so, there's nothing like a good ghost story. Tell us about the Western Reserve Ghost.
Boy, that was an interesting one because the other ship tale is Le Griffon, and there are some people who are familiar with that, the ghost mm-hmm. ship, the first so-called first sailing ship on the Great Lakes. Actually, I'm told it was the second. I do not know it was the first, mm-hmm. But the Western Reserve is less known.
And newer.
And it's a little more recent, yeah. Right, about this great ship that came out of Ohio, owned by a wealthy gentleman. And on its maiden voyage, it is coming from Ohio. Mm-hmm. And it encounters bad weather. And the rich gentleman, the owner, doesn't want to stop and does not listen to the advice of the captain on the ship. And so the ship is lost. But a gentleman over in Michigan, where the ship is to land, has a dream
mm-hmm.
about finding this man at washed ashore and
all dressed up
in a uniform, and he reaches for his hand, and then he tells his fellow workers about it, and they kind of laugh at him. But then, lo and behold, the actual gentleman who washes ashore is the rich man.
It's a little smacks of Titanic in there, too.
Yeah, a little bit of those dreams.
Well, a fascinating book. Cheryl James is the writer. Her book is Michigan Legends, Folk Tales and Lore from the Great Lakes State, published by the University of Michigan Press. Lots of fun and really something that really does give you a sense of just how rich the state is with history and, as you say, folk tales and lore. Cheryl, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.